Anyways, I guess they can see the tips, right? So we'll figure it out, or they'll figure it out. So, what I would like to continue to do is to talk about how we deal with relaxation in errors. You know, we had the DiVincenzo requirements that we needed a map, we needed a map of the physical system to qubits, we needed to initialize, we needed to make a measurement, we needed to control errors, we needed a complete set of gates. And the hard part of all that, close the door, is to control the errors. And the errors normally show up as something that we call relaxation. But relaxation comes in so many different flavors. We can't just say, oh, it's relaxation, we'll deal with it. So let me pick up as we left off, that if we applied a 90-degree pulse to a spin system, and we start off, of course, again in some equilibrium states, where the deviation part of the density matrix looks like sigma z. We rotate it here. It is minus sigma y from that rotation. And then it evolves, and we detect here, we take the expectation value of sigma x as a function of time. That's the detected signal. We get a combination of the expectation values along x and y. We store it as an imaginary number just to make things compact. And if Sophie asked, well, what is this signal as a function of time? The signal as a function of time is going to be some integral of a probability distribution. And remember that we're looking at a macroscopic ensemble of, you know, 10 to the 14, so we have a probability distribution. And there's going to be some field that we can think about. And if we have a field, we would need to have a frequency, so we'll multiply it by the gyromagnetic ratio, and we'll integrate over time. And we'll integrate, oh, and I'll need to include a relaxation time, and we'll integrate over all space. And so here we say, oh yeah, I have some spatially and temporally varying field. And normally, what one would like to do is to say, oh, well, this thing, S of t, looks like some simple function e to the I omega naught t, let's just call it omega t, some frequency which would be the average value of that field over the sample. Okay, some static piece of that field, we put it in here. E to the minus t over t2 star. That there's some part of this which looks exponential, and that piece that looks exponential, we can add it to this piece. And we could even go so far as to say that in the ideal system, this T2 is the same as T1, that T2 is limited by the lifetime of the spins. And we see that this can't be quite right, because we really do have a probability distribution, and that probability distribution is never unimportant. Do you have a question?
So the B field, that's real, right?
Yeah.
So the integral in the exponential is, okay, right, so it has the real
it's just a phase, right? A phase term. And the phase term, I'm going to take out a frequency dependence. So you know, there's some piece of it that's constant. And so let's make the whole thing more concrete. Let's just take, and this is what we did last time, we take B of R of T, T a gradient. So a linear gradient. And then we can rewrite this expression, S of t is equal to the integral of, and well, we'll leave it. E to the minus I kz e to the minus t over t2 dr. And here, I'll remind you that we defined k last time k of t to be gamma dz dz times t, which was just a wave number for this helix that we're winding the spins up in. And then here, you would recognize this piece here, you know, taking this out, but this is just a Fourier transform of the probability distribution. And so then you'd say that yes, at any instant in time, this piece here, although it is universally used in quantum information processing and in magnetic resonance, you know, it's probably not strictly true, it's not even approximately true, right? And this was useful because we wanted to remember that here, where we have a static probability distribution, so this is static, that although the signal will decay, right, it's going to decay as a Fourier transform in the probability distribution. So unless your probability distribution is periodic, then this thing is going to decay. Any general probability distribution is going to decay quickly. We haven't lost any information. We have a perfect correlation between the phase of the spin and its spatial location. And so because that information is not lost, we can always refocus it. And we look at that to apply pulse with some time tau. And following this, if we map S of t, we would have some signal that's decaying as a Fourier transform of that. And then at time 2 tau, we would have an echo of that signal. So it would be exactly the same shape. And this decay is e to the minus 2 over t2. Yeah. And this piece here, this thing which is not Gaussian, is approximated with a time constant t2 star. Yeah. And so we can see that, yeah, we have incoherence here. No information is lost, and we can in fact recover it. Two interesting things. One, the fact that this signal is a Fourier transform of the probability distribution of the spins is exactly what allows us to do imaging. So MRI uses just that principle. We take signal, take the inverse Fourier transform, we can discover the probability distribution of spins. And so the probability distribution of spins in MRI is the distribution of the water in your body. And so that is actually an easy task, and everything you need to know about it is right here. You can see that we have this term in here, which is a convolution kernel, right? So this term limits the resolution with which you can get your image. Yeah, it's exactly a convolution. So you can solve that. This piece, the fact that you get an echo here, discovered by Hahn in about 1950, and Hahn patented the idea as a way of doing information storage. He said that he could create some shape of the field here, which would create a free induction decay that would have a particular shape depending upon what the information is he wanted to store. and that sometime later he could recover that, and so he could use it as a memory. And IBM was interested in that. Unfortunately, you find that repeatedly published. So this is an idea that every couple of years it's published again. Now, here I've written this as a 90 and a 5 pulse. One of the things that you should look at is that any two pulses leads to an echo. And I can parameterize any two pulses as a pulse of nutation alpha about the x-axis. Remember, things are cylindrically symmetric here, so it doesn't matter what I choose that first phase is. And then a beta pulse about some axis rotated from the x-axis. And it's quite easy to show yourself that any two pulses gives you. Now, having this piece, we really want to, yeah.
So the second axis, is that also in the x-y plane?
It is. So it's just rotated by z rotation from the x-axis. Okay, having discussed this incoherence piece, and added a randomization. We're going to have decoherence. We're going to take incoherence and lose the correlations. And remember that the correlation in this case was the spatial location in the phase of the step. And so if I want to lose that correlation, then I want to lose the information about the locations of the molecules. And so by adding molecular diffusion, we lose that correlation and we go to something which is decoherent. And if it's decoherent, then there's no series of pulses which will ever recover that information, because the information is fully random. Now remember that what happened here is that if we have this field that is linearly increasing, then here the spins have been wrapped up into a spatial helix. And so that's the spins are in the XY plane, and they're wrapped up into a helix, and this parameter K we talked about, the wave number, is just the pitch of that helix. And so if we take this and I convolve that with the Gaussian distribution, knowing that the probability, we put it as a lowercase p, of moving by amount dz over some time t due to diffusion is equal to distribution that says that the spins are moving, and you can see what happens if the spins here move up or down, which they will move both, then we will attenuate that gradient. We won't change k, but the amplitude of the gradient will be attenuated. So we're just going to convolve these two together. We did that last time. And we found that there's an additional term to the attenuation in this case, and that we have an additional term that looks like e to the minus k squared dt over 3, or equivalently, e to the minus gamma squared dz dz squared t squared dt, and I have to put a factor of 3 there. Right, and this is the rate of attenuation of that. And this is a it looks like a very specific map, to the future, but actually it's a very general map because we've just added some random motion. And all we've said is that if there's a correlation, let's destroy that correlation by some random process. And so if I come back over here, and this now is an exponential decay. It's an exponential decay that is recognized, where that is 1 over the relaxation time. Yes?
I'm probably getting the geometry all wrong here. We started with the spins all pointing the same direction along the y-axis.
Yeah.
And then with the correlation that we are trying to decompare are in the xy plane.
Right. Yeah, so what we've done is we've wrapped the spins up as a helix with their magnetization remaining in the xy plane, but you know, as they move down, there's a rotation, just like there's the screws of a thread.
Right.
And that's what we've destructed. Okay, so now we can say that there's that the T2, and let's call it due to diffusion, but it's a T2 from any random process. Partial root. And this piece here, what am I doing? Thank you. This piece here is the RMS value of the field. So this says that we have some fluctuating field. We add gamma, of course, that would give us a fluctuating frequency. It's just a scaling law. And chi squared is the correlation. Tells us that the time over which things have not changed. And these correlation times are important if we're going to look at decoherence. And so if I look at an experiment, it's pi over 2, pi, we sample here, and I've set this to tau, in tau. And we ask, well, okay, there was a signal, it was attenuated, it appears over here, there's an effective T2, that effective T2 has two components to it, it has 1 over T2 observed equal to 1 over T2 plus 1 over T2 diffusion. Right, and that 1 over T2 diffusion has a correlation time of tau. Why a correlation of time? Because of tau, because we left the magnetic field gradient on continuously in this particular experiment. And so here, experimentally, the experimentalist gets to choose the correlation time, gets to choose the correlation time by applying this refocusing pulse. And so, as we saw last time, if we apply another refocusing pulse, so that this becomes pi over 2, this is still pi over 2 pulse and pi over pi, and now this is pi over 2. Then here the correlation time becomes tau over 2. And we can keep repeating this and make the correlation time shorter and shorter and shorter. To make the correlation times shorter, the T2 reduces. And so in this experiment, this echo is bigger than it was in that experiment. More and more I pack these things in, and you can see that there's a limit. As long as omega 1 times the correlation time is greater than 1, we can remove the effect of this decoherence. So decoherence is an irreversible loss of information. Okay? But we can still control the rate at which it's lost. And the rate at which it's lost depends upon the correlation time. And why omega 1 times tau? Well, omega 1 told us how quickly we could rotate the spins. And you can see that to achieve this modulation, I need to rotate the spins by this pi pulse. And so the picture is that I can put more and more and more of these pi pulses together. Okay, but at some point, it's going to be all pi pulses, and there's nothing more I can do. Okay, so that's why you end up with that limit. Now, this limit is exactly the same if the field was fluctuating. Right, so I could say, fine, don't change, don't put a pi pulse in. Imagine that the field, we have a pi over 2 pulse, and that the field is fluctuating with some characteristic frequency. And one of the nice things to look at is just take the field as a cosine function. So you get a periodic set of echoes, right? So that you can see that right there, I better get an echo. Yeah, now it's another echo here, etc. And calculate the size of those echoes as a function of the frequency of this. What you get down, of course, is a set of Bessel functions, right? Because you're looking at the exponent of a cosine term. And you'll see that as you make this correlation time, the frequency higher, the correlation time shorter, your intensity increases. And if you make it fast enough, then this effectively has no influence on the signal. Yeah? All right. Now, given this parameterization, we're in good shape, because now then we can go back to an earlier lecture and we can say, well, what is the Krauss picture of decoherence? And remember that the model for T2 processes in the operator sum representation required only two Krauss operators. We had a Krauss operator 1 minus some probability times the identity in the second Krauss operator, which is the square root of P times sigma z, that everything that's happening here is a sigma z rotation. And here, in this parameterization, we know now what this probability is, that the probability is equal to 0.5 by 0.5 e to the minus t over t2 diffusion. So for any time that I'm interested in, we can describe the Krauss operators. Okay, and remember that the T2 picture, since this commutes with the total Hamiltonian, it doesn't matter what interval of time we're describing. You also often see the Krauss operators described for infinitesimal times, right? And so I just expand this as 1 minus T over T2, right? And okay, so that cancels out, and we have a term that's T over T2, right? So we can say, oh yeah, for short times, this thing looks like, okay, so that's the Krauss picture, and it says that we can parameterize this. Now, this is great. This, of course, we can't parameterize with the Krauss operator, right? Because here we still have to keep that probability distribution, right? So there is no equally convenient way
of parameterizing it. I could put a Fourier transform in there. Okay. Good, we still have a little bit of time. I just want to make a point here to make sure that we're all on the same page. So let's say that I took this to some further extreme. We have a pi over 2, and then we have a pi pulse and a pi pulse. Lots of pi pulses. Yeah, you have a question.
Is there a matter of for small time, for more meters?
Yeah. Thanks. So now we have all of these pulses. Here we have some tau, which is correlation time, I'm going to put in there. And this is the parameter t. Right, just to make sure that you see that separation, that t isn't each of these pieces. You could re-describe it that way, but in this analysis, t is at some fixed point at the end. Okay. Now notice what happens here. In this case, we can remove the result of probability distribution of fields. If the fields are static, we can remove them very simply. It says it only costs me one pulse somewhere in the process. Really easy. If the fields are fluctuating, well, it costs me more pulses, but provided I'm in this limit, then life is easy and we can remove the effective errors and we can do it perfectly. What happens if we don't have that limit? Okay, so if we're not in the limit at omega t1, omega tau, it's much bigger than 1. In that limit, we cannot use this series of pi pulses to remove the influence of a static, of a fluctuating field. And so we need to have another approach to removing these errors. And there's a good chance to introduce another error suppression experiment, which is called the decoherence free subspace. So here we're saying that omega 1 tau sub c is not much greater than 1. It might be of order 1, it might be less than 1. And we still want to remove it. So we cannot use this process called the Carpersell sequence, or Carpersell-Mylan-Gill sequence, or decoupling, or dynamical decoupling. Again, it's a sequence that's been published many, many, many times. But all of those terms describe it. Yeah.
What were the names again?
So it was first published by Carr and Purcell. So Purcell, you know, from Harvard, but Carr was a student. And then Maidun and Gill published a very small change to it, an important small change to it. And then it was called, in general, dynamical decoupling by Jim Schulry, and generalized again. And then it was called coherent averaging by John Waugh with another generalization. And then it was rediscovered by quantum computing people, and they renamed it into dynamical decoupling. Okay, so here we want to store information. I need another resource. And what I'm going to, so this is not, again, a general solution. What we're going to do is to say that if I have two spins, and if they see the same field, Under that circumstance, I can use a symmetry of the system to avoid decohering the process. And so what we're going to do is to take two spins, and after those two spins, we're going to have one logical two-level system that's going to avoid any errors from this. And the logical coding that we'll use is some version of that. I'll say that if the spins are in this anti-aligned state, then I'm going to take those as the eigenbasis of this. And you can see the reason that we want to do that is if they see the same spin, then if the spin is in the downstairs, it will pick up, it'll rotate in one sense, and if it's in the upstairs, it'll rotate in another sense. And so the effective rotation of that two-level state is going to be zero. And what I'd like you to do is just show me that it works. So if I do this, then I want a set of operators. And the operators that we're going to look at are sigma z logical is equal to sigma z 1 minus minus minus. Okay, we'll just take that. And then sigma x logical is sigma x1, sigma x2, sigma y1, sigma y2. Sigma y logical, you can, of course, just get half the commutation of these two. So it will be sigma y1, sigma x2, minus sigma x1, sigma y2. Okay, so now we have a complete algebra. We need to know the identity term. And the identity logical is sigma z1, sigma z2. Okay, and now you can see what happens is if I have an operator space in SU4, but just the Hilbert space in SU4, labeled like that, we're living in that central 2x2 space. Yeah. And show me that here, as long as we have this symmetry, and regardless of what the correlation time is, we can suppress the errors. OK, now I want to turn to how we get T1 relaxation. So all of this was T2 relaxation, which is fairly simple. It says that there's no energy exchange, that all we have is fluctuations along the energy axis. So there's some fluctuations along the Z field. And if you look through quantum information processors, you find that experimentally, T2 is a challenge for most systems today. So flux qubits have a very hard time of having a T2 of something that is microseconds. Most systems decohere pretty quickly. But those problems aren't that interesting, in fact, that it's expected that people will find either the source of the noise, so it's a source of some energy fluctuation. So they'll find that, and they'll be able to remove it. Or they'll be able to use one of these two techniques to suppress the noise. And all it requires in both cases is that they have very simple single qubit rotations. Now, you know, you have to get into this state, right? And you can see that to get into this state, they need to be able to individually address the spins that make up, or the qubits that make up the. And if I want to have a rotation of the logical qubit, I need to have these two body terms, Right. And so those are a little bit challenging to create for some people, but in fact aren't that hard. Question.
So, it's track back a little bit. Can you just restate the formulation of the problem that you wanted us to look at? Just so that I have it a little
bit. So here I give you a mapping to logical qubits, and I even give you the operator space. And what I want you to show me is that if you have a randomly fluctuating field, that this mapping, these sets of states, this part of the density matrix, is preserved, regardless of what that fluctuating field is, regardless of what the correlation time of that fluctuating field is. Okay, so now we're going to turn to T1 processes. These are, in general, more difficult to control. They're more difficult to analyze. And generally, the reason is that the correlation times come in a more complicated way. Now, if we're thinking about spins are bloody, or any small half particle, they're bloody easy, because the only thing that can happen is magnetic-magnetic interactions. So if I have decoherence, then I need to say, well, where is a magnetic-magnetic interaction which is going to allow for an exchange of information? And the only process that we have is the dipolar interaction. So if I have a spin here and another spin there, and they don't need to be in the same molecule, they don't need to, there doesn't need to be any relationship between them, then clearly there's a dipolar energy that shifts one relative to the other and the other relative to that. And we can write down the dipolar Hamiltonian for that, and it is going to be the sum over all spins. It'll have frequency term, which we'll come back to. So this is going to look very similar to the chart we just looked at. Okay, so this looks very much like if I tell you that BKL is equal to 1 over RK L cubed, and it has some spatial coordinates built into it. Oh, okay. I didn't include the magnetic fields. The magnetic moments. They have a magnetic interaction. So here we have a simple description of the Hamiltonian. Looks very similar to the classical dipolar energy, right, which is the moments divided by R cubed, and then the projections divided by R to the cube. And that's all that happens. Now I'm going to take this dipolar term, and I'm just going to expand it out in terms of spin operators. And when we expand it out in terms of spin operators, then I'm going to group some terms. We get terms that look like sigma z, of course. I get terms that look like sigma x plus sigma y, But I'm going to write those in terms of the raising and lowering operators. Okay. I'm going to write those in terms of raising and lowering operators because this piece of it commutes with the Zeeman Hamiltonian. Right? So everything's good there. So this is the so-called secular parts of the dipolar Hamiltonian. And these terms will have an emotional dependence that looks like 1 minus 3 cos squared theta. Okay, so there, as we rotate the system, then we'll see a modulation of these terms. If I average 1 minus 3 cos squared theta over a sphere, so I take the hard average of this thing, that goes to 0, of course. And so, on average, there is no dipolar interaction, okay, if the spins are randomly moving relative to each other. Then there are terms that look like sigma z sigma plus, and there are terms that look like sigma z sigma minus. These things all have a dependence. That look like sine theta, cosine theta. And there's terms that look like sigma plus, sigma minus, and these things have dependence at sine squared theta. Good. Now, let's write down the energy level diagram for this. I'm going to write down the energy level diagram in the case that the two spins have the same ferromagnetic ratio. So sigma z, of course, is just a shift in the energy. And so all it's doing is changing these levels relative to those levels. This term, sigma plus, sigma minus, of course, is inducing a transition. It's inducing a transition that connects these two levels. And so it says that there is energy, that's not surprising. If the Zeeman energy is the same for the two spins, then if I flip them both, it's energy conserved. Okay, so that's of course what we mean by it being secular. This is important for relaxation because it gives it a mechanism for taking one relaxing spin and moving it through the lattice. Okay, so if I have a spin that is sigma z times the identity, right? So the first spin we say is polarized, the second spin is in the fully mixed state. And I apply to that this operation. And now I'm going to write it as Cartesian polys. Sigma x plus sigma y. And let's just go ahead and look at the evolution of this. Some angle. I don't really care about the angle right now. Now, of course, sigma x commutes with sigma y, so I'm free to separate this two. I'm going to. But the angle will be the same. That'd be a negative sign there. Now, of course, it's a trivial, it's only SU2, so it's trivial to calculate the effect of this, and we're going to see that this rotates into sigma y, sigma x. Right? And so we have terms here that look like sigma y, sigma x, and of course sigma z. And you know, that's going to appear with cosine theta, this will appear with sine theta, all that stuff. And then we apply these things. Now this term is going to rotate and to, and let me put the identity there, I want to keep that identity there. This term is going to rotate into sigma x, sigma y. So that is why I chose sigma y, sigma x, sigma y, as a y operator, the logic of qubits that we just looked at. You'll see that. So we have this term. We have sigma z identity, of course, and then you know, that just comes down. And then I have this term, and this term is going to evolve into the identity sigma z, right? And that is the transition I want to see. Okay, and then of course it comes down as it's all. And so we see that there's this transformation under this, what's so-called flip-flop interaction, that allows us to transport magnetization through the lights. And so this piece says that if I have a relaxation sink over here, this spin is relaxing, then the spins in between can mediate the relaxation of some faraway spin. Okay. Now, this is a process that you need to think about a little bit to understand, because of course, if I take as my spin pool all of the spins, then this process doesn't lead to any relaxation. Right, because the fact that I've flipped one says I've had to rotate another one into that same state, and so that the integrated magnetization over the sample doesn't change. If, however, there are two pools of spin, one pool, the first spin, a second pool, the second spin, then this actually does lead to relaxation. Okay, so the T1 process, as we describe it, depends upon whether we're looking at the T1 process of the entire ensemble, or there's some mechanism by which we can take a part of that ensemble. Yeah. Okay. Now, these terms, of course, lead to processes here. So this is sigma plus or minus sigma z, right? And this is sigma z, sigma plus or minus, connecting those terms. And so here we have terms that lead directly to relaxation. And then there's the term that connects this two photon term, sigma plus, sigma minus, right? In all of those, we can count it. Now then, so here we have a set of Hamiltonians that are going to connect the energy levels and lead to relaxation. Okay, and of course, these terms lead to relaxation even in a case where we've pooled all the spins into one package. And then we ask, how do we calculate the effective probabilities that we would like to have in some Krauss operator? The way we do that is to go to second order perturbation theory. And all I'm going to do is write down the result, because I'm sure you've seen second order perturbation theory even a few times in the last few weeks. Now, you know, we have to go to second order because I want to connect different levels, right? First order, we're just shifting the energies. So I need to go to second order. So change in the density matrix, I mean, that's what we care about, is going to be an integral over time small. Okay, so let's see what we said. H effective is the Hamiltonian as rotated into the energy axis. So I'm going to demand a few things here. The first thing I'm going to demand is that H effective on average is equal to zero. The reason I want to do that is if there's any time-independent part of that Hamiltonian, then let's just put it into the interaction frame. Let's just put it into some unitary evolution. If there's a time-independent part that leads to a unitary rotation, and here there's no reason to build up a unitary rotation. And the problem, of course, with taking a unitary and calculating its effect in perturbation theory is we would need to include all orders. So it would be a draft. So we just remove it. Life would be much easier. This bar says that we have an ensemble average. So we've got our 10 to the 14 spins. We're going to average over the dipolar interaction over all of them. Rho of zero allows us to have an equilibrium. But we could simply set that to zero and look at the decay and get the right time constant. We can get back to the equilibrium, we get the right time constant. So this isn't so important for most of what we want to do. What's important right here is that we look at the correlation function of the effective field. That what's happening, just like we saw in the magnetic case of a random magnetic field, is that it's not the size of the effective field that matters. It's how it varies in time and the fluctuations of it that matter. And here, in the case of the static field, when we're calculating T2, it commuted with the Zeeman interaction. So I didn't need to take it into an interaction frame to suppress its time dependence. It was already in that frame. Here, I in fact need to take it into the interaction frame. And as I take it into the interaction frame, these things, of course, commute. So these are going to contribute at frequencies equal to zero. So the log time average of these contributes. How does it contribute? This one, not very much. This one contributes because it allows us to move information around. These contribute at omega is equal to omega naught, at the resonance frequency. So here, in order to see that there's a term of these effective Hamiltonians that remains, we need to rotate the system at plus and minus omega. That would remove the time dependence of the individual term, and we can measure the correlation function. These terms, so I should put plus and minus there. These terms have frequencies of omega plus and minus twice omega naught. Right, that's their frequency dependence. Okay, so I'm going to look at the spectral densities of the fluctuating fields. So how do these things fluctuate? Well, we said that we had two spins. We had one spin here and one spin there. They have to fluctuate to cause relaxation. So that means that this angle between the applied magnetic field and this intranuclear vector, right? The z-axis is this way. So that's I and j, theta ij. And that is the angle that is appearing here. This has to fluctuate. Nicely, it averages to zero, right? Because we need that to have that piece. It averages to zero, but it still has to fluctuate. But it's not only that it fluctuates. In order to cause a relaxation, if we're looking at these single quantum terms, So having wave changes of 1, then it has to fluctuate at omega naught. And if we're looking at having Hemming wave 2, then it has to fluctuate plus or minus twice omega naught. And if there's a process where the flip-flop term would lead to relaxation, then it's the DC part of that which would lead to relaxation. Okay, we can show that. Now, having said that,
So the omega naughts are the frequencies associated with the energy difference.
Right, so the omega naught comes from the Zeeman-Hamiltonian, which says that we have omega naught frequency, and sum over all spins. Omega is a frequency at which we would measure the correlation function. So this is the frequency of the correlation function. And look at what happens. Let's say I choose to look at some frequency other than omega naught. And I'm looking at this term. Then there's going to be the difference frequency called delta omega, which is the frequency I'm doing the averaging over, minus omega naught. And this difference is always going to be cosine of that frequency. So then when I average over random phases, it's going to go to 0. Right? So the only place that this is going to contribute is where I sample at omega naught so that piece becomes static. Okay, and then what fluctuations remain are the fluctuations that come from some molecular dynamics. Okay, and so, you have two averages here. You have one averaging that says there's an averaging because the Hamiltonian itself lends structure to the energy landscape. And there's a second averaging that says the molecules are tumbling. Now then, okay, so we can take this and we can rewrite the Krauss operators. What would they look like? They would look exactly like this, right? That we would have a term here that says, oh yeah, there's sigma x e plus sigma x plus sigma x e plus and e minus sigma x plus sigma x e minus, and then I have to change that to y as well, right? So we have 4 of those terms, and each of those terms would come in with equal probability, and the probability of those would be this integral evaluated at omega naught. Oh, I'm sorry. These are idempotents. So e plus minus is equal to 1/2 the identity plus minus sigma z. Having said all that, if you take any molecular system and you crank through it, you never, ever, ever get the right number. And the reason is that these molecular dynamics are too bloody complicated, and we're coarse graining over everything. And remember that the dipolar interaction is logarithmically divergent, conditionally convergent, whatever language you like to use. But it doesn't allow you to have a cutoff. It doesn't say, oh, let's just look at the first few molecules. Because if I look at the first angstrom, or if I look at the first nanometer, or I look at the first meter, I look at the first kilometer, they're all equally important. And so we don't have any rights to have a cutoff in this. And so as we try to integrate that, it becomes a mess. And we can see the trends correctly. That's easy. But in terms of actually getting out the number, that's been abysmal. Okay. We're out of time, but can I still take 5 minutes, or will they get in?
Well, I think they'll come in a few minutes, but
I will just take a few minutes. Yeah.
Is the Hamiltonian there, is it the tree in front of the garage there?
Yeah.
Is it missing it to give you a freedom, like?
Yes, that's all it is, yeah. Okay. Let's imagine that I have a simple system where I have a carbon spin. The carbon spin's what I want. And there's a dipolar interaction and a chemical shift. It'll take too long, so I'll tell you tomorrow. But you can use this, even though we can't calculate it, we can use it to create effective decoherence through subspaces that suppress the effect. And in fact, I can suppress the dipolar interaction. So there's still some control, we still can remove the errors. Okay? But that's the structure of that. Yeah. And I don't write out the full Krauss picture because it gets a little bit messy, but it's straightforward to do. And when you do write out the full Krauss picture, it's easy to see the difference if you combine these processes together. If I say, the first spin and the second spin are the same pool of spins, and I'm combining them, then of course I have to combine these operators. When I combine those operators into the same jump operator, you'll see effective symmetries coming out of that. Yeah?